Sarah. Hollis rubbed his beard, nodding.
It would appear so.
Michael had been drifting in and out of a formless sleep when he heard the door opening. A girl stepped around the screen. Younger than Billy, but with the same funny orange costume and severe haircut. She was holding a tray before her.
I thought you might be hungry.
As she advanced into the room, the smell of warm food hit Michael's senses like an electric current. He was suddenly ravenous. The girl placed the tray on his lap. Some kind of meat in a brown gravy, boiled greens, and most wondrous of all, a fat slice of buttered bread. Metal utensils lay beside it, wrapped in a rough cloth.
I'm Michael, he offered.
The girl nodded faintly, smiling.
Why was everybody always smiling? I'm Mira.
She was blushing, he saw. What little hair she possessed was so fair it was practically white, like a little's.
I was the one who took care of you.
Michael wondered what this meant exactly. In the hours since he'd awakened, bits of memory had come floating back to him. The sound of voices, shapes and bodies moving around him, water on his body and moistening his mouth.
I guess I should say thank you. Oh, I was glad to do it.
She studied him for a moment.
You're really from away, aren't you?
Away? She gave a delicate shrug.
There's here, and there's away.
She lifted her nose toward the tray.
Aren't you going to eat?
He started with the bread, soft and wonderful in his mouth, then moved on to the meat and finally the greens, stringy and bitter but still satisfying. While he ate, the girl, who had taken a chair beside his bed, kept her eyes on him, her face rapt, as if each bite he took brought her pleasure as well.
What strange people these were.
Thanks, he said, when all that remained was a smear of grease on his plate.
How old was she, anyway?
16? That was fantastic.
I can get you more. Whatever you want.
Really, I couldn't eat another bite. She took the tray from his lap and put it aside. He thought she was preparing to leave, but instead she moved toward him again, standing close to the cot, which was positioned high off the floor.
I like watching you, Michael.
He felt his face grow warm.
Mira?
It's Mira, right?
Nodding,
she took his hand from where it lay on the sheet and wrapped it in her own.
I like how you say my name.
Yes. Well,
But he couldn't continue.
She was suddenly kissing him. A wave of sweet softness filled his mouth. He felt his senses collapsing.
Kissing him? Of all things, she was kissing him. And he was kissing her. Papa says I can have a baby, she was saying, her breath warm on his face. If I have a baby, I won't have to go to the ring. Papa says I can have anyone I want. Can I have you, Michael? Can I have you?
He was trying to think, to process what she was saying and what was happening, the taste of her, and also the fact that she had now, it seemed, climbed on top of him, straddling him near the waist, her face still pushed into his own, a collision of impulses and sensations that rendered him into a state of mute compliance.
A baby? She wanted to have a baby? If she had a baby, she didn't have to wear a ring?
Mira! A moment of complete disorientation. The girl was gone, vaulted away. The room was suddenly full of men, large men in orange jumpsuits, crowding the space with their bulk. One of them caught Mira by the arm. Not a man. Billy.
I'll pretend, she said to the girl, that I didn't see this.
Listen, Michael said, finding his voice. It was my fault. Whatever you think you saw, Billy nailed him with a cold glare. Behind her, one of the men snickered.
Don't even pretend this was your idea. Billy pointed her eyes at Mira again. Go home, she commanded. Go home now.
He's mine. He's for me.
Mira, enough. I want you to go straight home and wait there. Don't talk to anyone. Do I make myself understood?
He's not for the ring, Mira cried. Papa said.
That word again, Michael thought. The ring. What was the ring? He will be unless you get out of here. Now go. These last words appeared to work. Mira fell silent and, without looking at Michael again, darted behind the screen. The feelings of the last few minutes, desire, confusion, embarrassment, were still whirling inside him while another part of him was also thinking, just my luck. Now she'll never come back. Danny, go bring the truck around back. Tip, you stay with me.
What are you going to do with me?
Billy had withdrawn a small metal tin from somewhere on her person. With thumb and forefinger, she pinched a bit of dust from the tin and sprinkled it into a cup of water. She held it out to him. Bottoms up.
I'm not drinking that.
She sighed impatiently. Tip, a little help here. The man stepped forward, towering over Michael's bed. Trust me, Billy said. You won't like the taste, but you'll feel better fast. And no more fat lady.
The fat lady, thought Michael. The fat lady in the kitchen in the time before. How did you...
Just drink. We'll explain on the way. There seemed no way to avoid it. Michael tipped the cup to his lips and poured it down.
Flyers, it was awful. What the hell is that?
You don't want to know. Billy took the cup from him. Feeling anything yet? He was. It was as if someone had plucked a long, tight string inside him. Waves of bright energy seemed to radiate from his very core. He'd opened his mouth to declare this discovery when a strong spasm shook him, a gigantic, whole-body hiccup.
That happens the first time or two, said Billy. Just breathe.
Michael hiccuped again. The colors in the room seemed unusually vivid, as if all the surfaces around him were part of this new nexus of energy.
He'd better shut up, warned Tip. It's fantastic, Michael managed to say.
He swallowed hard, pushing the urge to hiccup down inside him. The second man had returned from the hallway.
We're losing the light, he said briskly. We'd better get a move on.
Get him his clothes. Billy steadied her gaze on Michael again. Peter says you're an engineer, that you can fix anything. Is that true? He thought of the words on the paper Sarah had slipped him. Tell them nothing. Well?
I guess.
I don't want you to guess, Michael. It's important. You can or you can't. He glanced toward the two men who were looking at him expectantly, as if everything depended on his answer.
Okay.
Yes. Billy nodded. Then put your clothes on and do everything we tell you. Chapter 50 Mausami in darkness, dreaming of birds. She awoke to a quick, bright fluttering beneath her heart, like a pair of wings beating inside her.
The baby, she thought. This baby is moving.
The feeling came again, a distinct aquatic pressure, rhythmic, like rings widening on the surface of a pool, as if someone were tapping at a pane of glass inside her. Hello? Hello out there? She let her hands trace the curve of her belly under her shirt, damp with sweat. A warm contentment flooded her.
Hello, she thought. Hello back, you?
The baby was a boy. She'd thought it was a boy since the start, since the first morning at the compost pile when she'd lost her breakfast. She didn't want to name him yet.
It would be harder to lose a baby with a name, that's what everyone always said. But that wasn't the real reason, because the baby would be born. The idea was more than hope, more than belief. Now Sami knew it for a fact. And when the baby was born, when he'd made his loud and painful entry into the world, Theo would be there. And they would name their son together. This place, the haven, it made her so tired. All she could do was sleep and eat. It was the baby, of course. It was the baby that made her think about eating all the time. After all the hard tack and bean paste and that awful strange food they'd found in the bunker, 100-year-old goop vacuumed in plastic, it was a miracle they hadn't all poisoned themselves. How amazing to have real food. Beef and milk, bread and cheese. Actual butter so creamy it made the top of her throat tickle. She shoveled it in, then licked her fingers clean. She could have stayed in this place forever, just for the food. They'd all felt it right away. Something wasn't right. Last night, all those women crowding around her, holding babies or pregnant themselves, some actually both, their faces beaming with a sisterly glow at the discovery that she was pregnant too. A baby. How wonderful. When was she due? Was it her first? Were any of the other women in their group also with child? It hadn't occurred to her at the time to wonder how they'd known. She was barely showing, after all, nor why none had asked who the father was or mentioned the fathers of their own children. The sun was down. The last thing Mausami remembered was lying down for a nap. Peter and the others were probably in the other hut, deciding what to do. The baby was moving again, flipping around inside her. She lay with her eyes closed and let the sensation fill her. Standing the watch. It seemed like years ago. A different life. That was what happened, she knew, when a person had a baby. This strange new being grew inside you, and by the time it was all over, you were someone different, too. Suddenly she realized. She wasn't alone. Amy was sitting on the bunk next to hers. Spooky the way she could make herself invisible like that. Mausami rolled to face her, tucking her knees to her chest as the baby went thump, thump inside her. "Hey," Maus said and yawned. "I guess I took a little nap there." Everybody was always talking that way around Amy, stating the obvious, filling the silence of the girl's half of the conversation. It was a little unnerving the way she looked at you with that intense gaze, as if she were reading your thoughts. Which was when Mausami realized what the girl was really looking at. "Oh, I get it," she said. "You want to feel it?" Amy cocked her head, uncertain. "You can if you want. Come on. I'll show you." Amy rose, taking a place on the edge of Mausami's cot. Mausami held her hand and guided it to the curve of her belly. The girl's hand was warm and a little damp. The tips of her fingers were surprisingly soft, not like Mausami's, which were calloused from years of the bow. "Just wait a minute. He was flipping around in there a second ago." A bright flicker of movement. Amy drew her hand away quickly, startled. "You feel that?" Amy's eyes were wide with pleasant shock. "It's okay, that's what they do. Here." She took Amy's hand and pressed it to her belly once more. At once, the baby flipped and kicked. "Whoa, that was a strong one." Amy was smiling too now. How strange and wonderful, Mausami thought, in the midst of everything, all that had happened, to feel a baby moving inside her. A new life. A new person coming into the world. Mausami heard it then. Two words. "He's here." She yanked her hand away, scurrying up the cot so she was sitting with her back pushed to the wall. The girl was looking at her with a penetrating stare, her eyes filling Mouse's vision like two shining beams. "How did you do that?" She was shaking.
she thought she might be ill.
He's in the dream. With Babcock. With the many. Who's here, Amy?
Theo?
Theo is here.
Chapter 51. He was Babcock, and he was forever. He was one of 12, and also the other, the one above and behind, the zero. He was the Knight of Knights, and he had been Babcock before he became what he was. Before the great hunger that was like time itself inside him, a current in the blood, endless and needful, infinite and without border, a dark wing spreading over the world. He was made of many. A thousand, thousand, thousand scattered over the night sky like the stars. He was one of 12 and also the other, the zero. But his children were within him also, the ones that carried the seed of his blood, one seed of 12. They moved as he moved. They thought as he thought. In their minds was an empty space of forgetting in which he lay, each to a one, saying, "You will not die. You are a part of me as I am a part of you. You will drink the blood of the world and fill me up." They were his to command. When they ate, he ate. When they slept, he slept. They were the we, the Babcock, and they were forever as he was forever, all part of the 12 and the other, the zero. They dreamed his dark dream with him. He remembered a time before he became. The time of the little house in the place called Desert Wells. The time of pain and silence. And the woman, his mother, the mother of Babcock. He remembered small things. Textures, sensations, visions. A box of golden sunlight falling on a square of carpet. A worn place on the stoop that fit his sneakered foot just so, and the ridges of rust on the rail that cut the skin of his fingers. He remembered his fingers. He remembered the smell of his mother's cigarettes in the kitchen where she talked and watched her stories, and the people on the television, their faces huge and close, their eyes wide and wet, the women with their lips painted and shimmering like glossy pieces of fruit. And her voice, always her voice. "Be quiet now, goddammit. Can't you see I'm trying to watch this? You make such a goddamn racket, it's a wonder I don't lose my goddamn mind." He remembered being quiet. So quiet. He remembered her hands. Babcock's mother's hands. And the starry bursts of pain when she struck him. Struck him again. He remembered flying, his body lifted on a cloud of pain, and the hitting, and the slapping, and the burning. Always the burning. "Don't you cry now. You be a man. You cry and I'll give you something to cry about. So much the worse for you, Giles Babcock." Her smoky breath close to his face. The look of the red-hot tip of her cigarette where she rolled it against the skin of his hand, and the crisp, wet sound of its burning, like cereal when he poured milk into it, the same crackle and pop. The smell of it mingling with the jets of smoke that puffed from her nostrils. And the way the words all stopped up inside him, so that the pain could end. So he could be a man, as she said. It was her voice he remembered most of all. Babcock's mother's voice. His love for her was like a room without doors, filled with the scraping sound of her words, her talk, talk, talk. Taunting him, tearing into him, like the knife he took from the drawer that day as she sat at the table in the kitchen of the little house in the place called Desert Wells, talking and laughing and laughing and talking and eating her mouthfuls of smoke. "The boy isn't just dumb. I tell you, he's been struck dumb." He was happy. So happy. He'd never felt such happiness in his life as the knife passed into her, the white skin of her throat, the smooth outer layer, and the hard gristle below. And as he dug and pushed with his blade, the love he felt for her lifted from his mind so that he could see what she was at last. That she was a being of flesh and blood and bone. All her words and talk, talk, talk moving inside him, filling him up to bursting. They tasted like blood in his mouth. Sweet, living things. They sent him away. He wasn't a boy after all. He was a man. He was a man with a mind and a knife, and they told him to die. Die, Babcock, for what you have done. He didn't want to die. Not then. Not ever. And after. After the man, Walgast, had come to where he was, like a thing foretold. And after the doctors and the sickness and the becoming, that he should be one of 12, the Babcock, Morrison, Chavez, Baffis, Terrell, Winston, Sosa, Eccles, Lambright, Martinez, Reinhardt, Carter, one of 12, and also the other, the zero. He had taken the rest the same way, drinking their words from them, their dying cries like soft morsels in his mouth. And the ones he did not kill, but merely sipped, the one of 10, as the tide of his own blood dictated, became his own, joining to him in mind. His children. His great and fearful company. The many. The we of Babcock. And this place. He had come to it with a feeling of return, of a thing restored. He had drunk his fill of the world, and here he rested, dreaming his dreams in the dark, until he awoke, and he was hungry again, and he heard the zero, who was called Fanning, saying, "Brothers, we're dying, dying." For there was hardly anyone left in the world, no people, and no animals even. And Babcock knew that the time had come to bring those that remained to him, that they should know him, know Babcock and the zero also, assume their place within him. He had stretched out his mind and said to the many, his children, "Carry the last of humankind to me. Do not kill them. Bring them and their words, that they should dream the dream and become one of us, the we, the Babcock." And first one had come, and then another, and more, and more, and they dreamed the dream with him, and he told them, when the dreaming was done, "Now you are mine also, like the many. You are mine in this place, and when I am hungry you will feed me, feed my restless soul with your blood. You will bring others to me from beyond this place that they should do the same, and I will let you live in this way and no other." And those that did not bend their wills to his, that did not take up the knife when the time had come in the dark place of dreaming where Babcock's mind met theirs, they were made to die so the others could see and know and refuse no longer. And so the city was built. The city of Babcock, first in all the world. But now there was another. Not the zero or the 12, but another. The same and not the same. A shadow behind a shadow, pecking at him like a bird that darted from sight whenever he tried to fix the gaze of his mind upon her. And the many, his children, his great and fearful company, heard her also. He sensed her pull upon them, a force of great power, drawing them away, like the helpless love he had felt so long ago when he was just a boy, watching the red-hot tip rolling, rolling, and burning against his flesh. "Who am I?" they asked her. "Who am I?"
She made them want to remember. She made them want to die. She was close now. Very close. Babcock could feel it. She was a ripple in the mind of the many, a tear in the fabric of night. He knew that through her, all that they had done could be undone. All that they had made could be unmade. Brothers. Brothers. She is coming. Brothers. She is already here.
Chapter 52
"I'm sorry, Peter," said Olson Hand. "I can't keep track of all your friends."
Peter had learned that Michael was missing just before sunset. Sarah had gone over to the infirmary to check on him and found that his bed was empty. The whole building was empty. They had fanned out in two groups. Sarah, Hollis, and Caleb to search the grounds, Alicia and Peter to look for Olson. His house, which Olson had explained had once been used as the warden's residence, was a small two-story structure situated on a patch of parched ground between the work camp and the old prison. They had arrived to find him stepping from the door.
"I'll speak with Billy," Olson continued. "Maybe she knows where he went."
He seemed harried, as if their visit had caught him in the midst of some important duty. Even so, he took the trouble to offer one of his reassuring smiles.
"I'm sure he's fine. Mira saw him in the infirmary just a few hours ago. He said he was feeling better and wanted to have a look around. I thought he was probably with you."
"He could barely walk," Peter said. "I'm not sure he could walk at all."
"In that case, he can't have gone far, now could he?"
"Sarah said the infirmary was empty.
Don't you usually have people there?"
"Not as a general matter. If Michael chose to leave, they'd have no reason to remain." Something dark came into his face. He leveled his eyes at Peter.
"I'm sure he'll turn up.
My best advice would be to return to your quarters and wait for his return."
"I don't see..."
Olson cut him off with a raised hand.
"As I said, that's my best advice. I suggest you take it. And try not to lose any more of your friends."
Alicia had been silent until now. Suspended on her crutches, she bumped Peter with her shoulder.
"Come on."
"But it's fine," she said. Then, to Olson,
"I'm sure he's okay. If you need us, you know where to find us."
They retreated through the maze of huts. Everything was strangely quiet, no one about. They passed the shed where the party had been held, finding it deserted. All the buildings were dark. Peter felt a prickling on his skin as the cooling desert night descended, but he knew this sensation was caused by more than just a change in temperature. He could feel the eyes of people watching them from the windows.
"Don't look," Alicia said. "I feel it too. Just walk."
They arrived at their quarters as Hollis and the others were returning. Sarah was frantic with worry. Peter related their conversation with Olson.
"They've taken him somewhere, haven't they?" Leash said.
It seemed so. But where? And for what purpose? Olson was lying, that was obvious. Even more strange was the fact that Olson seemed to have wanted them to know he was lying.
"Who's out there now, Hightop?"
Caleb had taken his position by the door.
"The usual two. They're hanging out across the square, pretending they're not watching us."
"Anyone else?"
"No. It's dead quiet out there. No Littles, either."
"Go wake up Mouse," Peter said. "Don't tell her anything. Just bring her and Amy over here. Their packs, too."
"Are we leaving?"
Caleb's eyes shifted to Sarah, then back again.
"What about the circuit?"
"We're not going anywhere without him. Just go." Caleb darted out the door. Peter and Alicia exchanged a look. Something was happening. They would have to move quickly. A moment later, Caleb returned.
"They're gone."
"What do you mean, gone?" The boy's face was gray as ash.
I mean, the hut's empty. There's no one there, Peter.
It was all his fault. In their haste to find Michael, he'd left the two women alone. He'd left Amy alone. How could he have been so stupid?
Alicia had put her crutches aside and was unrolling the bandage from her leg. Inside, secreted there on the night of their arrival, was a blade. The crutch was a ruse. The wound was nearly healed. She rose to her feet. "Time to find those guns," she said. Whatever Billy had put in his drink, the effects hadn't worn off yet. Michael was lying in the back of a pickup, covered with a plastic tarp. The bed of the truck was full of rattling pipes. Billy had told him to lie still, not to make a sound, but the jumpy feeling inside him was almost more than he could bear. What was she doing, giving him a concoction like that and expecting him to lie perfectly still? The effect was like shine in reverse, as if every cell in his body were singing a single note, like his mind had passed through some kind of filter, giving each thought a bright, humming clarity. "No more dreams," she'd said. "No more fat lady with her smoke and smell and awful, scratchy voice." How did Billy know about his dreams? They'd stopped once, just a few moments after they'd left the infirmary, which they'd exited through the rear. Some kind of checkpoint. Michael heard a voice he didn't recognize, asking Billy where she was going. From under the tarp, Michael had listened anxiously to their exchange. "There's a broken line out in the eastern field," she explained. "Olson asked me to move these pipes around for the crew tomorrow."
"It's new moon. You shouldn't be out here."
New moon, Michael thought.
What was so important about the new moon?
"Look, that's what he said. Take it up with him if you want."
"I don't see how you're going to make it back in time."
"Let me worry about that. Are you going to let me through or not?"
A tense silence. Then, "Just be back by dark." Now, sometime later, Michael felt the truck slowing once again. He drew the tarp aside. A purpling evening sky, and behind them, in the truck's wake, a boiling cloud of dust. The mountains were a distant bulge against the horizon. "You can come out now." Billy was standing at the tailgate. Michael climbed from the truck bed, grateful to move at last. They had parked outside a massive metal shed, at least 200 meters long, with a bulging convex roof. He saw the rusted shape of fuel tanks behind it. The land was lined with railroad tracks, heading off in all directions. A small door opened in the side of the building. A man emerged and walked toward them. His skin was covered in grease and oil, so much that his face was practically black with it. He was holding something in his hands, working at it with a filthy rag. He stopped where they were standing and looked Michael up and down. A short-barreled shotgun was holstered to his leg. Michael remembered him as the driver of the van that had brought them from Las Vegas. "This him?" Billy nodded. The man moved forward so their faces were just inches apart and peered into Michael's eyes. First one eye, then the other, shifting his head back and forth. His breath was sour, like spoiled milk. His teeth were lined in black. Michael had to force himself not to pull away.
"How much did you give him?"
"Enough," Billy said.
The man gave him one more skeptical look, then stepped back and shot a jet of brown spit onto the hardpan.
"I'm Gus."
"Michael."
"I know who you are."
He held up the object for Michael to see.
"You know what this is?"
Michael took it in his hand.
"It's a solenoid, 24 volts. I'd say it comes off a fuel pump, a big one."
"Yeah? What's wrong with it?"
Michael passed it back, shrugging.
"Nothing I can see."
Gus looked at Billy, frowning.
"He's right.
I told you."
"She says you know about electrical systems, wiring harnesses, generators, controller units."
Michael shrugged again. He was still reluctant to say too much. But something, some instinct, was telling him he could trust these two. They hadn't brought him all this way for nothing.
"Let me see what you've got."
They crossed the rail yard to the shed. Michael could hear from inside the roar of portable generators, the clang of tools. They entered through the same door the man had emerged from. The interior of the shed was vast, the space illuminated by spotlights on tall poles. More men in greasy jumpsuits were moving about. What Michael saw stopped him where he stood. It was a train. A diesel locomotive. And not some rusted derelict either. The damn thing looked like it could actually run. It was covered in protective metal plating, 3/4-inch steel at least. A huge plow jutted from the front of the engine. More steel plates were riveted over the windshield, leaving only a thin slit of exposed glass for the driver to see by. 3 boxy compartments sat behind it. "The mechanicals and pneumatics are all up and running," Gus said. "We charged the 8 volts using the portables. It's the electrical harness that's the problem. We can't pull a current from the batteries to the pump." The blood was racing through Michael's veins. He took a breath to calm himself. "Do you have schematics?" Gus led him to a makeshift desk where he'd laid out the drawings, broad sheets of brittle paper covered in blue ink. Michael looked them over. "This is a rat's nest," he said after a moment. "It could take me weeks to find the problem."
"We don't have weeks," Billy said.
Michael lifted his face to look at them.
"How long have you been working on this thing?"
4 years, Gus said, give or take. "So how much time do I have?" Billy and Gus exchanged a worried glance.
"About 3 hours," said Billy.
Chapter 53
Theo. He was in the kitchen again. The drawer was open. The knife lay gleaming there, tucked in the drawer like a baby in its crib.
"Theo, come on now. I'm telling you, all you got to do is pick it up and do her. You do her and this will all be over."
The voice. The voice that knew his name, that seemed to crawl around inside his head, waking and sleeping. Part of his mind was in the kitchen, while another part was in the cell where he had been for days and days, fighting sleep, fighting the dream.
"Is that so fucking hard? Am I not being absolutely clear here?"
He opened his eyes. The kitchen vanished. He was sitting on the edge of the cot, the cell with its door and its stinking hole that ate his piss and shit. Who knew what time it was? What day, what month, what year? He had been in this place forever.
"Theo, are you listening to me?"
He licked his lips, tasting blood. Had he bitten his tongue? "What do you want?" A sigh from the far side of the door.
"I gotta say, Theo, you do impress me. Nobody holds out like this. I think you've got some kind of record going."
Theo said nothing. What was the point? The voice never answered his questions. If there even was a voice. Sometimes he thought it was just something in his head.
"I mean some, sure," the voice went on. "In some cases you could say it goes against the grain, carving the old bitch up."
A dark chuckle, like something from the bottom of a pit.
"Believe me, I've seen people do the damnedest shit."
It was terrible, Theo thought, what staying awake could do to a person's mind. You went without sleep long enough, you made your brain stand up and walk around day after day after day, no matter how tired you felt. You did push-ups and sit-ups on the cold stone floor until your muscles burned. You scratched and slapped yourself and dug at your own flesh with your bloodied nails to keep awake. And before long you didn't know which was which, if you were awake or asleep. Everything got blended together. A sensation like pain,
only worse because it wasn't a pain in your body. The pain was your mind, and your mind was you. You were pain itself.
You mark my words, Theo. You do not want to go there. That was not a story with a happy ending.
He felt his awareness folding again, taking him down into sleep. He dug his nails hard into his palm.
Stay awake, Theo.
Because there was something worse than staying awake, he knew.
Sooner or later, everybody comes around, is what I'm saying, Theo. Why do you keep using my name?
I'm sorry? Theo, did you ask me something? He swallowed, tasting blood again, the foulness of his own mouth. His head was in his hands.
My name. You're always saying it.
Just trying to get your attention. You haven't been yourself much these last few days, if you'll pardon my saying so.
Theo said nothing.
So okay, the voice went on. You don't want me to use your name.
Don't see why not, but I can live with that.
Let's change the subject.
What are your thoughts on Alicia? Because I do believe that girl is something special.
Alicia? The voice was talking about Alicia?
It simply wasn't possible.
But nothing was, that was the thing. The voice was always saying things that were impossible.
Now I thought it would be Mausami, the way you described her,
the voice went merrily on.
Back when we had our little talk, I was pretty sure my tastes would run in her direction. But there's something about a redhead that just gets my blood boiling.
I don't know who you're talking about. I told you. I don't know anyone by those names.
You dog, Theo. Are you trying to tell me you put the wood to Alicia, too? And Mausami in the condition she is?
The room seemed to tip.
What did you say?
Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't hear? No, I'm surprised she didn't tell you. You're Mausami, Theo.
The voice lifted to a kind of sing-song. Got a little bun-ski in the oven-ski. He was trying to focus, to hold the words he was hearing in place so he could grasp their meaning. But his brain was heavy. So heavy, like a huge slippery stone, the words kept sliding off.
I know, the voice went on. It came as a shock to me, too. But back to Leash. If you don't mind my asking, how does she like it? I'm thinking she's an on-all-fours, howl-at-the-moon kind of girl. How about it, Theo? Set me straight here if I'm wrong.
I don't know. Stop using my name.
A pause.
All right. If that's how you want it. Let's try a new name, shall we? How about Babcock?
His mind clenched. He thought he might be sick. He would have been if there had been anything in his stomach to come up.
Now we're getting somewhere. You know about Babcock, don't you, Theo?
That was what was on the other side of the dream. 1 of 12. Babcock.
What is he?
Come on, you're a smart fellow. You really don't know?
An expectant pause.
Babcock is you.
I am Theo Jackson, he thought, saying the words in his mind like a prayer. I am Theo Jackson, I am Theo Jackson, son of Demetrius and Prudence Jackson, first family. I am Theo Jackson.
He's you. He's me. He's everyone, at least in these parts. I like to think he's kind of like our local god. Not like the old gods. A new god. a dream of God we all dream together. Say it with me, Theo. I am Babcock. I am Theo Jackson. I am Theo Jackson. I am not in the kitchen. I am not in the kitchen with the knife. Shut up. Shut up, he begged. You're not making any sense. There you go again, trying to make sense of things. You gotta let go, Theo. This old world of ours hasn't made sense in 100 goddamn years. Babcock isn't about making sense. Babcock just is. Like the we. Like the many. The words found Theo's lips.
The many.
The voice was softer now. It floated toward him from behind the door on waves of softness, calling him to sleep. To just let go and sleep. That's right, Theo. The many. The we. The we of Babcock. You gotta do it, Theo. You've gotta be a good boy and close your eyes and carve that old bitch up. He was tired. So tired. It was like he was melting from the outside in, his body liquefying around him, around the single overwhelming need to close his eyes and sleep. He wanted to cry, but he had no tears to shed. He wanted to beg, but he didn't know what for. He tried to think of Masami's face, but his eyes had closed again. He had let his lids fall shut, and he was falling, falling into the dream. It's not as bad as you think. A bit of a tussle at the start. The old gal's got some fight in her, I'll give her that. But in the end, you'll see. The voice was somewhere above him, floating down through the warm yellow light of the kitchen. The drawer, the knife, the heat and smell and the tightness in his chest, the silence plugging his throat and the soft place on her neck where her voice was bobbing in its rolls of flesh. I tell you, the boy isn't just dumb. He's been struck dumb. Theo was reaching for the knife. The knife was in his hand. But a new person was in the dream now. A little girl. She was seated at the table, holding a small, soft-looking object in her lap. A stuffed animal. This is Peter, she stated in her little girl's voice, not looking at him. He's my rabbit. That's not Peter. I know Peter. But she wasn't a little girl. She was a beautiful woman, tall and lovely, with tresses of black hair that curved like cupped hands around her face. And Theo wasn't in the kitchen anymore. He was in the library, in that terrible room with its stench of death and the rows of cots under the windows, and on each cot the body of a child, and the virals were coming. They were coming up the stairs. Don't do it, said the girl, who was a woman now. The kitchen table at which she sat had somehow traveled to the library, and Theo saw that she wasn't beautiful at all. In her place sat an old woman, wizened and toothless, her hair gone ghostly white. Don't kill her, Theo. No. He jerked awake, the dream popping like a bubble. I won't do it. The voice broke into a roar. God damn it, you think this is a game? You think you get to choose how this is gonna go? Theo said nothing. Why wouldn't they just kill him? Well, okay then, partner. Have it your way. The voice released a great final sigh of disappointment. I got news for you. You're not the only guest in this hotel. You won't like this next part very much, I don't expect. Theo heard the boots scraping on the floor, turning to go. I had higher hopes for you. But I guess it's all the same. Because we're going to have them, Theo. Mouse and Alicia and the rest. One way or the other. We're going to have them all.
Chapter 54. It was the new moon, Peter realized, as they made their way through the darkness. New moon, and not one soul about. Getting past the guards had been the easy part. It was Sarah who had come up with a plan. "Let's see Leash do this," she had said, and marched straight out the door across the square to where the two men, Hap and Leon, were standing by a fire barrel, watching her approach. She stepped up to them, positioning herself between them and the door of the hut. A brief negotiation ensued. One of the men, Hap, the smaller of the two, turned and walked away. Sarah ran one hand through her hair. The signal. Hollis slipped outside, ducking into the shadow of the building, then Peter. They circled around to the north side of the square and took positions in the alleyway. A moment later, Sarah appeared, leading the remaining guard, whose quick step told them what she'd promised. As she walked past them, Hollis rose from his hiding place behind an empty barrel, wielding the leg of a chair. "Hey," said Hollis, and hit the one named Leon so hard he simply melted. They dragged his limp body deeper into the alley. Hollis patted him down. Strapped to the man's leg in a leather sheath, hidden under the jumpsuit was a short-barreled revolver. Caleb appeared with a length of laundry line. They bound the man's hands and feet and stuffed a wadded rag into his mouth. "Is it loaded?" Peter asked. Hollis had opened the cylinder. "Three rounds." He snapped it closed with a flick of his wrist and passed the weapon to Alicia. "Peter, I think these buildings are empty," she said. It was true. There were no lights anywhere. "We better hurry." They approached the prison from the south, across an empty field. Hollis believed the entrance to the building was located on the far side, facing the main gate to the compound. There was, he said, a kind of tunnel there, the entrance arched in stone and set into the wall. They would attempt this if they had to, but it stood in full view of the observation towers. The plan was to look for a less risky way in. The vans and pickups were kept in a garage on the south side of the building. It would make sense for Olsen and his men to keep their hard assets together, and in any event, they had to look somewhere first. The garage was sealed, the doors drawn down and secured with a heavy padlock. Peter looked through a window but could see nothing. Behind the garage was a long concrete ramp leading to a platform with an overhang and a pair of bay doors set in the prison wall. A dark stain ran up the middle of the ramp. Peter knelt and touched it. His fingers came away wet. He brought his fingers to his nose. Engine oil. The doors had no handles, no obvious mechanism by which they could be opened. The five of them formed a line and pressed their hands against the smooth surface, attempting to draw it upward. They felt no sharp resistance, only the weight of the doors themselves, too heavy to lift without something to grip. Caleb scampered back down the ramp to the garage. A crash of glass, and he returned a moment later, holding a tire iron. They formed a line again, managing to lift the door far enough for Caleb to wedge the iron under it. A blade of light had appeared on the concrete. They drew the door upward and ducked through one by one and let it fall closed behind them. They found themselves in some kind of loading area. There were coils of chain on the floor, old engine parts. Somewhere nearby water was dripping. The air smelled like oil and stone. The source of the light lay up ahead, a flickering glow. As they moved forward, a familiar shape emerged from the gloom. A Humvee. Caleb opened the tailgate. "Everything's gone, except for the 50 cal. There are three boxes of rounds for that." "So where are the rest of the guns?" Alicia said. "And who moved this in here?" "We did." They swiveled to see a single figure step from the shadows. Olsen Hand. More figures began to emerge, surrounding them. Six of the orange-suited men, all of them armed with rifles. Alicia had drawn the revolver from her belt and was pointing it at Olsen. "Tell them to back off." "Do as she says," Olsen said, holding up a hand. "I mean it. Guns down, now."
One by one, the men dropped the barrels of their weapons. Alicia was the last, though Peter noted that she didn't return the gun to her belt, but kept it at her side. "Where are they?" Peter asked Olson. "Do you have them?" "I thought Michael was the only one." "Amy and Malsami are missing." He hesitated, appearing perplexed. "I'm sorry. This isn't what I intended. I don't know where they are. But your friend Michael is with us."
"Who's us?" Alicia demanded. "What's going on, goddammit? Why are we all having the same dream?"
Olson nodded. "The fat woman."
"You son of a bitch, what did you do with Michael?"
With that, she raised the gun again, using two hands to steady the barrel, which she aimed at Olson's head. Around them, six rifles responded in kind. Peter felt his stomach clench.
"It's all right," Olson said quietly, his eyes fixed on the barrel of the gun.
"Tell him, Peter," Alicia said. "Tell him I will put a bullet in him right here unless he starts talking."
Olson was gently waving his hands at his sides.
"Everyone stay calm. They don't know. They don't understand."
Alicia drew her thumb down on the hammer of the revolver to cock it.
"What don't we know?"
In the thin lamplight, Olson appeared diminished, Peter thought. He seemed hardly the same person at all. It was as if a mask had fallen away and Peter was seeing the real Olson for the first time. A tired old man, beset by doubt and worry.
"Babcock," he said. "You don't know about Babcock."
Michael was on his back, his head buried beneath the control panel. A mass of wiring and plastic connectors hung above his face.
"Try it now."
Gus closed the knife switch that connected the panel to the batteries. From beneath them came the whir of the main generator spinning up.
"Anything?"
"Hang on," Gus said. Then, "No." The starter breaker popped again. There had to be a short in the control harness somewhere. Maybe it was the stuff in the drink Billy had given him, or all that time he'd spent around Elton, but it was as if Michael could actually smell it. A faint aerial discharge of hot metal and molten plastic, somewhere in the tangle of wires above his face. With one hand he moved the circuit tester up and down the board. With the other he gave a gentle tug at each connection. Everything was tight. He shimmied his way out and drew up to a seated position. The sweat was pouring down. Billy, standing above him, eyed him anxiously.
"Michael."
"I know, I know."
He took a long swig from a canteen and wiped his face on his sleeve, giving himself a moment to think. Hours of testing circuits, tugging wires, backtracking each connection to the panel, and still he'd found nothing. He wondered, what would Elton do? The answer was obvious. Crazy, perhaps, but still obvious. And in any event, he'd already tried everything else he could think of. Michael climbed to his feet and moved down the narrow walkway connecting the cab with the engine compartment. Gus was standing by the starter control unit, a penlight tucked in his mouth. "Reset the relay," he instructed. Gus spat the flashlight into his hand. "We've already tried that. We're draining the batteries. We do this too many times, we'll have to recharge them with the portables. 6 hours at least."
"Just do it."
Gus shrugged and reached around the unit, into its nest of pipes, feeling his way blind. "Okay. For what it's worth, it's reset." Michael stepped back to the breaker panel.
"I want everybody to be very, very quiet."
If Elton could do it, so could he. He took a deep breath and slowly released it as he closed his eyes, trying to empty his mind. Then he flipped the breaker. In the instant that followed, a splinter of a second, he heard the spin of the batteries and the rush of current moving through the panel, the sound in his ears like water moving through a tube. But something was wrong. The tube was too small.
The water pushed against the sides, and then the current began to flow in the wrong direction, a violent turbulence, half going one way and half the other, canceling each other out, and just like that, everything stopped. The circuit was broken. He opened his eyes to find Gus staring at him, mouth open, showing his blackened teeth.
"It's the breaker," Michael said.
He drew a screwdriver from his tool belt and popped the breaker from the panel.
"This is 15 amps," he said. "This thing wouldn't power a hot plate. Why the hell would it be 15 amps?
He gazed up at the box, its hundreds of circuits.
"What's this one, in the next slot? Number 26.
Gus examined the schematic that was spread out on the tiny table in the engine's cab. He glanced at the panel, then back to the drawing. Interior lights.
Flyers, you don't need 30 amps for that.
Michael jimmied the second breaker free and swapped it for the first one. He closed the knife switch again, waiting for the breaker to pop. When it didn't, he said,
"That's it."
Gus was frowning doubtfully.
"That's it?"
"They must have gotten switched. It's got nothing to do with the head end unit. Reset the relay and I'll show you."
Michael moved forward to the cab, where Billy was waiting in one of the two swiveling chairs at the windshield. Everyone else was gone. They'd left just after sundown in Billy's pickup to meet them at the rendezvous. Michael took the other chair. He turned the key set in the panel beside the throttle. From below, they heard the batteries spinning up. The dials on the panel began to glow, a cool blue. Through the narrow slit between the protective plates, Michael could see a curtain of stars beyond the open doors of the shed.
Well, he thought, it's now or never.
Either there was current to the starter or there wasn't. He'd found one problem, but who knew how many others there might be. It had taken him 12 days to fix one Humvee. Everything he'd done here, he'd done in a little under 3 hours. Michael lifted his voice to the rear of the car, where Gus was priming the fuel system, clearing any air from the line.
"Go ahead!"
Gus fired the starter. A great roar rose from below, carrying the satisfying smell of combusting diesel. The engine gave a shuddering lurch as the wheels engaged and began to push against their brakes.
"So," Michael said, turning to Billy, "how do you drive this thing?"
Chapter 55. In the end, they could only take Olsen at his word. They simply had no choice. They divvied up the weapons and split into two groups. Olsen and his men would storm the room from ground level while Peter and the others entered from above. The space they called the ring had once been the prison's central courtyard, covered by a domed roof. Part of the roof had fallen away, leaving the space open to the outside, but the original structural girders were intact.